Okay, so Mr. Shem, we're going to start this shir on Tanya, all the way from the beginning, and hopefully with time, plow our way through a little bit. The intention is I'm going to try and balance. I want to do it inside, although I also want to cover a little bit of ground. So we might, from time to time, is summarize certain parts outside, but sort of keep going a little bit, particularly today. So just a little bit of an introduction. First of all, I mean, this might be familiar to some, but I just wanted to go through it anyway. So the Tanya is a book known as it's a seminal work, the foundation of Chabad Chassidus. It was written by the Alter Rebbe, but it's interesting how it was written by the Alter Rebbe. It was written first of all, why was it written and how was it written? Just give a bit of context. So it was written by the Alter Rebbe, actually in response, as he puts in the Hakdama in the introduction, is written in response to people's questions in serving Hashem, right? The Alter Rebbe writes that it's impossible to see everyone individually. And he wrote that, yes, it's true, it's always good to hear from someone personally rather than read what's written, and so on, as he explains at length. But nevertheless, he writes, "B'yoidai umakirai ka'amina." I'm talking about people that I know, that I'm familiar with, and if I know the issues, which, according to the way the Rabbeim explained this, it doesn't only mean the people who he knew in that generation, it means he knows the challenges and the struggles of every person and the way they serve Hashem. So when we learn Tanya, we become included in that category of Yoidai Kamira, people that Alter Rebbe knows. So therefore, he decided to write a sefer addressing a formula, addressing the issues that people have in Avodas Hashem. In other words, basically he's saying is, if you learn Tanya, you can find the answer to the pathway to serve Hashem properly. But when he wrote it originally in booklet form, in like just manuscripts. It wasn't actually properly printed. It was called kuntresim, just sort of leaflets that would come out. And after a while, it was decided, and it was a whole question and so on, that he was going to print it. It was printed in 1797, Tov Kuf Nun Zayin, which was 2 years before the Alter Rebbe was arrested and liberated, which was 2 years later. In other words, that was in 1799, right? Just a little bit interesting story. So we know that when the Alter Rebbe was in prison, we know that he was visited by the Magid and the Baal Shem Tov. The Magid was written in the Baal Shem Tov, who had passed on already, but he was visited by them. And he asked him, why is he sitting in jail? And explained to him, because the famous thing, that he had been spreading very deep ideas of Chassidus in a context of Chassidus Chabad, in other words, to understand and to internalize lofty and very transcendent ideas, and therefore there was a blockage in heaven, and therefore he had to actually sit in jail because it was like this kitrug, this accusation. So he asked them, if that's the case, when I come out, should I stop? And they said, no, once you've broken it through, spiritually broken it through, you should continue. But what's interesting is, why am I telling you the story now, is because Alter Rebbe was in jail for 53 days, and there's 53 chapters in the first part of Tanya, right? Because it had to do with the Tanya that was printed 2 years before that. What's fascinating in that story is the following. That when the Alter Rebbe agreed that the Tanya should be printed, he asked that it should be ready on Yutes Kislev. Now, what was the significance of Yutes Kislev then? It was the yahrzeit of his Rebbe, the Mizritcher Magid, right? It's known that the Mizritcher Magid also passed away on Yutes Kislev. In fact, just before the Mizritcher Magid passed away, he took the Alter Rebbe's hand, and he said, Yutes Kislev is unzer yontev. He said, Yutes Kislev is our yontev. Yeah, fascinating thing. Which wasn't revealed why until much later. Okay, I wasn't optimistic enough, so I wanted to copy short. You got a book? Okay, no, it's okay, good. So that was an amazing thing. So the Alter Rebbe the Mizritcher Magid took the Alter Rebbe's hand and said that, but only later become, now, so therefore the Alter Rebbe wanted, that since the Tanya is very much based on some of the teachings of the Mizritcher Magid, and that's his Rebbe, that the Tanya should be ready on Yutes Kislev. And actually it wasn't. It came a day late. So we know that the Tanya was officially printed on Chof Kislev. And the story goes that when the Tanya eventually arrived by the Alter Rebbe, he took the Tanya and he said, Chof Kislev, Chof Kislev, Chof Kislev. And no one knew what the Alter Rebbe was talking about. It was only later, when the whole story of Yutes Kislev happened and the Alter Rebbe was liberated on Yutes Kislev and by mistake taken to the wrong house and actually wasn't fully liberated until Chof Kislev, then the Chassidim understood the significance of him saying Chof Kislev, Chof Kislev, Chof Kislev, because actually the story of Yutes Kislev only ended up really on Chof Kislev, which is an amazing thing. Okay. So that's number one. Number two is the Alter Rebbe took many, many years to write the Tanya, because he wrote it in a way that was very specific and he was very exact with his language. To the point there are things I think that are unknown to us, even what the complexity are. The Alter Rebbe would wait and think about whether he should spell a word with a vav or without a vav. Or sometimes you have in Tanya when he quotes a saying or a pasuk, and he wants to say chulu or v'chulu, which means etc. in Hebrew. You'll see sometimes it says chulu, sometimes it says v'chulu, right? Or goimer and v'goimer, like etc. for a pasuk. And the Alter Rebbe was once found thinking and he was saying, he was like, for weeks he was contemplating whether to put a vav or without a vav. What the meanings of that is, I don't know. But I'm just saying, it was very, very exact. The language was extremely exact. And he wrote the Tanya in two sections. Now, if you open up a book in Tanya, you'll see there's five sections. But those sections were added. They're all from the Alter Rebbe, but they were added later by the Mittler Rebbe and others. Right? So today the Tanya is known as five different sections. Likutei Amorim, Shari Yichud Amunna, Geres HaTshuva, Geres HaKodesh, Kodesh Achron. But I'll just explain. So the first two sections are the original Tanya. The first one is called Likutei Amorim, which the Alter Rebbe in great humility called a collection of sayings, meaning it's not his, it's from his Rebbe, so to speak, and called the Sefer Shel Beinanim, the Book of Beinanim, which we'll expand on in a minute. That was the first one. And the second one was called Shar HaYichud VaEmunah, which is the gate, the understanding of the oneness and the faith in Hashem. Now, the first chelek, known as the Book of Beinanim, is more about serving Hashem and the struggle between the animal soul and the godly soul, as we'll learn in great deck, right? And how do you overcome the struggles and how do you come to serve Hashem and so on. The second one is more about understanding the depth of oneness of Hashem, the way the Baal Shem Tov explained it. Essentially, not that there's only one God, but there's only one reality, really, right? That's the concept. Interestingly enough, I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with this, interestingly enough, the Alter Rebbe wrote Shar Yichud V'Emunah to be the first section. And what we learn in our Tanya, the first part was supposed to be the second section. Then he changed his mind, right? And he started knowing to do the first section is going to come first, because that's the practical guide to serving Hashem. However, what the Rebbe points out is interesting, and that is that there's still a room to conceptualize the second section as the first section. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. Because and how do we know that? Because there are times in the second section, Shar Yichud VaEmunah, even though the Alter Rebbe chose it to print it second, but there's like one or two things where he says, as Kasher Yisbo'er, as it will be explained, referring to an explanation in the first section. But he left the future tense in. In other words, the way it's printed now, it should say, Kasher Nisbo'er, as it was already explained, if that's section two. But he left the word in the future tense, Yisbo'er, it will be explained, even though he decided to put it the other way around, right? Because there's different explanations on it, but the two go together, right? In other words, to really understand and to really conceptualize and to internalize what the Alter Rebbe explains in the first Chelek of Tanya, you need to understand the second Chelek of Tanya. Because really, Chassidus, ultimately, the Mittler Rebbe says, the second Rebbe says that the whole point of Chassidus was to explain one thing, Achdus Hashem, the oneness of Hashem. Basically, this world is nothing, it's all one part of Hashem. Wilderness doesn't count, only the reality is Hashem and what's connected with Hashem, and all those Torah mitzvahs and the neshama and so on and so forth, right? Then you have to understand the practical pathway and formula to understanding how to serve Hashem. So that's what Alter Rebbe decided to put first, but remembering that it goes together with the second chelik as well. No, in Beretz Hashem, when we get through the 53 parakim, we'll go to the second section, right? Okay, it's very deep, the second section, very, very deep. I mean, so it's first section, but that's good. Okay, just a little story that I'll tell you when a couple of things about the book of Tanya. When the Alter Rebbe printed the Tanya, so he got haskomis, what do they call them in English? What's it called? Approbations, yeah. From three people, from two tzaddikim in particular, Zushav Anipoli and Reb Leib. Sorry, Reb Yehuda Leib HaKoyen, who both lived in Anipoli. The idea was to give like haskom of Tanya, and also because they were printing it, there was a historical thing to it, a halachic thing, that the Alter Rebbe was worried that once it's printed, those days printing was a huge deal, And there were a printing press that decided they will print a Tanya at a huge expense. And then they were going to sell the books of Tanya, obviously, right? That was part of the income. And Adarab was worried that other printing presses would then compete with them and try print the Tanya, and they wanted to put like a ban on printing the Tanya for a while without permission, and that was part of the approbations that they wrote. But and then there was another one also from the children of the Alter Rebbe. But when the Alter Rebbe sent a shliach, he sent a messenger to Anipoli, so the manuscripts of Tanya arrived at the house of Rabbi Zusha of Anipoli and Rabbi Yehuda Leib HaKohen, and they both arrived in the evening, and they were both sat down to study the Tanya. Rabbi Zusha was learning the Tanya, and he finished it. And that night, he decided, this is unbelievable, he has to go and see Rabbi Yehuda Leib HaKohen. And the same thing happened to Rabbi Yehuda Leib HaKohen. He was studying Tanya, and he got to share this with Rabbi Zusha. None of them knew that the other one has it already. And they met, it says, in the middle of the town, on a bridge, I think it was. And the expression the Hasidim always say is, that when the two tzaddikim met with such an unbelievable ecstasy about the Tanya, ganz anipoli hot gebrennt. The whole Anipoli was on fire. That was the Tanya. The Baditshever was also a mechutin of the Alter Rebbe. When he got the Tanya, he said he doesn't understand how it's possible to put such a big God in such a small book. That was his comment on Tanya. Anyway, so it's a foundational thing. So the Alter Rebbe wrote what we call Chassidim called the Sharblat, which I wanted to start today and start at the beginning of Perek Aleph. Just because it's quite an important foundation, and I want to explain something a little bit that's very important to understand as we approach Tanya. Okay. So, you have it on the... Yeah, does anyone have it? It's this part, this thing. Right, just the first part. So it says like a Sefer Likutei Amorim. So the book is called a Sefer of Collection of Sayings, Chelek Rishon. The first section, which when the Alter Rebbe printed it, was the first section. Hanikra B'Shem Sefer Shel Beinonim. It's called the Book of Beinonim. And as we'll see, where the Alter Rebbe starts Tanya, there's a Tzaddik, and there's a Beinoni, and there's a Rasha. And the Alter Rebbe gives a whole new depth into what the word Beinoni means. Essentially, what the Alter Rebbe will come and teach us is Tzaddikim, in the true sense of the word, is something that is reserved for a select few. It's not even an aspiration. Beinoni, for the common person, Beinoni is what we all should be, but we should also aspire to, but the way the Alter Rebbe explains it, which we'll talk about this in a minute. Okay. Says the Alter Rebbe, what is it? Meluket mipi sofrim umipi soifrim. It is a gathering from books and scribes. The tradition amongst Chassidim is, who's the Alter Rebbe referring to? What's Tanya based on, essentially? So Svarim, books, is a reference to the Shaloh HaKadosh, who was a big Makubal, and a lot of concepts of Chassidus are based on the Shaloh, and the Maharal, right? Who the Alter Rebbe happened to be a descendant of, by the way, right? And Sofrim, scribes, is a reference to the Baal Shem Tov and the Magid, the two teachers of the Alter Rebbe. The direct teacher of the Alter Rebbe was the Magid, the Mizrich, who was a student of the Baal Shem Tov. The Alter Rebbe considered himself a spiritual grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, famous thing. He used to refer to him as Zayda, and that's what Chassidus is based on, right? Kadosh Elyon is a holy people, Nishmasim Eden, a blessed memory, and so on. And he says, Meyusid al Pasuk, the whole Tanya is based on the Pasuk, a Pasuk in Dvarim, in the book of Dvarim. Ki korev eilecha hadover ma'oid, that this thing, now by the way, when the Pasuk says this thing, it's actually a big machloikas, so what it's referring to. But the Alter Rebbe is using the Pshat here because according to some, it's referring only to Tshuva. It's referring to the context of what the Chumash happens to be talking about over there. But actually, the Pshat that's accepted and the Alter Rebbe is based on is it's referring to the whole Torah. Right? The Moshe Rabbeinu is telling the Jewish people as they're going to the Eretz Yisrael that the Torah is accessible. Korov, accessible. It's a hard word to... The word Korov means close, but it means in context, it means... It's accessible, it's easy, it's relevant, it's something you can access. Ha'ilecha ha'dover mo'ed. And it's very, very easy, it's very accessible to you. How's it accessible to you? Beficha in your mouth, ubilvavcha in your heart, la'asoyse, and to do it. Right? So the main difficulty of this pasuk, does anyone know what it is? Main difficulty? What is it? No, it's what is it specifically? We know the Alter Rebbe is based on the means of the whole Torah. All Torah, right? But the difficulty that the Tanya is based on to come and answer is we can understand that it's accessible if you talk about speech. In other words, Yeah, everyone has a choice. Everyone can learn Torah and keep and daven. You might not be in the mood, but you might not like it, but you can do it. Everyone can do it, essentially. Maybe not that easy, but it's accessible. La'asoy action is also very accessible. I mean, we all have a choice to do mitzvahs if we want to, right? Sorry?
To feel.
To feel. Oh, so bilvavcha is the main problem here. Meaning, the problem is all them, is because we say the word kikorev, it's very easy, it's very close. Okay, that you can really say that on anything. I mean, is it that accessible? It's difficult, it's a struggle. But, okay, but we understand more when it comes to beficha and la'asoysoy. The problem is bilvavcha, to feel it. It's very hard to tell someone you have to feel something. Now this question is not a question in Chassidus, it's a question in the Rambam already. Right? As we know that it's a question on the mitzvah of Avas Hashem, particularly the concept of loving Hashem. That's the most difficult thing. Right? You either love something or you don't love it. I mean, you can force someone to do something, you can't force them to love something, right? You can force your child to tidy up the room, but you can't force them to love tidying up the room. You know what I'm saying? Like it's not right? So that's the question. And the problem is that the Torah actually, well, it's two problems really. First of all, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. You have to love Hashem, right? Number one. Number two, not only it's a mitzvah, but as the Alter Rebbe brings later in Tanya, it's the foundation of Torah mitzvahs. You have to have some level of avas Hashem and yiras Hashem. As the Zohar says, that love of Hashem and fear of Hashem are like wings that carry the bird. So imagine the bird as being the Torah mitzvahs. But we can do Torah mitzvahs, but they're not holy necessarily. They're not elevated. They don't carry us, or they are not carried to a higher level, right? It's Ava, the two wings, Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, love of Hashem and fear of Hashem, that carry the mitzvahs to a greater level, yeah? So the shaila is, how's that korev? How's that accessible? Yeah? And says the Alter Rebbe that he's going to explain this, b'derech arucha uktsara b'ezras Hashem yizbarach. In a way that is long and short with the help of Hashem. Now, just to clarify what that means, there's a famous Gemara. I'm just going to show you in 1 second. Yeah, it's a Gemara in Eruvin, which talks about Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah. Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah said, he was very smart and a very great tzaddik, and he said, no one ever like defeated me an argument or like an exchange, except for one child. He said, how did the child defeat me? He said, Pa Machas, one time I was traveling and I needed to go to a particular city and I saw a child, it's a famous thing, saw a child sitting at a crossroads. And I said to him, my son, how do you get to the city? He said, you want the long short way or the short long way? That's a Gemara, this is a Gemara. So he told him, give me the short long way. So he told him. So he took a shortcut, and then he comes to the city, and there's like trees and bushes, and he can't get in, right? It's very hard. So he goes back, and he said, what are you doing? He said, you asked me for the short, long way. He said, yeah, the beginning was very short, but it's actually very long to get there, because you're going to have to navigate the trees and the thing at the end. But if I would have given you the long way is a long way, but when you get there, it's right there, the door's open, right? So the Alter Rebbe says the same thing is with Avodas Hashem. There is ways to serve Hashem, which is not the track that Tanya takes, not the track that Chabad takes in general, right? And that is, sometimes a person can do many things, he can experience many things which are unbelievably inspirational, right? You can engage in a very, very inspirational experience, and you can be boosted and injected and just fly, right? And at that moment, maybe you can even experience a level of Avas Hashem to some degree, and you can, that level of Avas Hashem can even inspire Torah mitzvahs. The problem is, it's not internalized. So it's a long, short way, because it actually doesn't lead you to the sustainable level of Avodas Hashem in a concrete and internalized way. Yeah? Alter Rebbe says, I'm going to explain to you how the Torah mitzvahs is korev elecha, is accessible to you, including bilvavcha, including Avas Hashem, in a way that is long, hard work, but sustainable, internalized. That's a ruchok tzara. And he ends off by saying, Be'ezra Hashem Yisbarach, we're going to do with the help of Hashem. So the Rebbe once said, I was at the Farbring, and I remember very clearly this sikha. In fact, I'll tell you when it happened. It was spoken by the Rebbe, and There used to be a Yid called Rabbi Weinberg, Olav HaShalom, and he started many, many, many years ago. Tanya on the radio, every Matzah Shabbos, he would give a shir in Tanya. It was a very beautiful thing. He used to send notes into the Rebbe before Shabbos. The Rebbe would sometimes make edits in his explanations, tell him to explain it a different way, etc. And eventually became printed, I think, in that book. What's that book you're holding there? Shurim Sefer Tanya in English. So it's based on that. And then, like, it took 20 years, because it was very small. Every Matzah Shabbos was very, like, short. Sometimes he would also repeat some sichas of the Rebbe in that Shabbos that he's spoken about. So it took a time. Anyway, it took 20 years to finish, and then there was a big siyum. After the Rebbe spoke that Shabbos in honor of the siyum, and the Rebbe spoke about the Sharblat, about what we're learning now, the introductory page. And the Rebbe explained a beautiful pshat about the word Be'ezras Hashem Yisbarach. So the simple pshat the Alter Rebbe wrote is we're going to explain it, but derech arucha oktzara in a long and short way with the help of Hashem. In other words, I'm going to explain it, but we'll explain it with the help of Hashem. But the Rebbe explained a deeper pshat. That you have to know that even when you engage in serving Hashem, but derech arucha oktzara, you take a very long way and you work very hard and you be mizboina and you reflect and you meditate and you really internalize the concepts as in Tanya, still know that you can't do it on your own. You always need with the help of Hashem. It's not referring to the Alter Rebbe explaining it with the help of Hashem, it's referring to us, that we reach a level of serving Hashem. Even that needs to be with the help of Hashem. A person should never think they can do it on their own. You know what I'm saying? So that's a beautiful show. Okay. Okay, now I can turn the page. We're going to actually start the actual Tanya. But I want to give a little introduction before we start. This is a very fundamental introduction to learning Chassidus in general and Tanya specifically. And I think it's an important introduction specifically in today's culture. I'll explain to you why I'm saying that in a second. So the Alter Rebbe is based on the concept of a Beinoni, right? As we'll learn, a Beinoni normally is just an average guy. He has a bit of mitzvahs, a bit of averus, you know, that kind of thing, right? The Alter Rebbe is going to redefine the whole concept. We'll explain it as we go along, but we'll redefine the whole idea of tzaddik and beinoni. Tzaddik will become something that is not even meant to be accessible to the average person. That's fine. It's a role that only certain people play. A real tzaddik, always a true tzaddik. And the beinoni is going to be the one that we're supposed to pursue, aspire to, right? However, as we'll see, the beinoni is not so simple, right? And it almost becomes, for the average person, unattainable. I venture to say that, I mean, there is a letter of the Rebbe somewhere where he explains that sometimes a person can experience a momentary mindset of being a Beinoni, but in a normal, ongoing, routine level, I don't think there are only very select people probably that have ever reached a Beinoni, right? So the question is, then what's the point, right? What's the point of giving us a book that we can't really attain, right? And I think we need to be honest about that. The honest thing is that, I'm sorry, I don't know everyone's madrega in serving Hashem yet, but a guess is that, starting from myself, is we're not going to become Beinoni in the true sense of the word. So then what's the point, right? And this question can be asked on many, many things in Chassidus, right? Chassidus Chabad particularly, has a habit of introducing us to study things that seem completely out of our reach. And it's an important thing to understand why that is, right? Why am I saying that? Because there's a tendency sometimes for people to distort the meaning of what it says in order to make it more accessible. And I think nowadays there's even a more temptation to do that because there's a culture that exists in the general society today that people don't like to be imperfect, right? They're uncomfortable for being lacking, to say, no, I'm actually not the way I should be, right? I'm actually very, very imperfect. Right, there's a huge emphasis on accepting ourselves, and I mean, on some level, that's a good thing. But you know, all that kind of stuff, not very in the lexicon of Chassidus, actually. Right, I mean, there's an intrinsic accepting of ourselves that deep down we all have a neshama and so on and so forth. But on a conscious level, we're actually taught not to accept ourselves the way we are. The whole point of Chassidus is to push us, right? It's to push us further than we are. Not to accept where we are and who we are, at least on a conscious level. But the way it works is, number one. First of all, one of the ideas of Chassidus is not to be just a practical guy to serve Hashem. So it's important to understand. Part of the point of learning Chassidus is to delve and explore transcendent stuff. Because it elevates us. It makes us more refined. It makes us more connection to Hashem. There's a pasuk that says, Da es alakei avicha. You should know Hashem as much as you can. Now, we can't know Hashem because Hashem is beyond us. But there's a commandment in the Torah to understand Hashem as much as we can. Therefore, Chassidus will talk about Atzilus and lofty worlds and levels in spheres and the difference between Ak, Machshava, Duma, Da'ak, and I don't know, whatever, Arich and Keser and all these things. Most of which we will learn and think, well, I don't know how relevant that is to me. And some of the stuff, it doesn't even matter if it's not relevant. The point is just to delve into it. Right? When our minds swim and explore stuff that is so lofty, we become more refined. And hopefully then it makes a difference of just becoming more spiritual in general and more godly in general. So that's one thing. All right? If it doesn't happen, by the way, you just have to learn more. You know, there's a famous little word they say, they always used to say in Yeshiva, at Fabringens and so on, they used to say, that there's a famous word like this, that if a person drinks alcohol, they become drunk, right? That's true, right? They say if a person has too much money, they become crazy. If a person learns chassidus, they become refined. So what happens if a person drank mashke and he didn't get drunk? Does that disprove the theory that alcohol makes you drunk? No, it just means it didn't have enough, right? If a person has money and he's not crazy, it doesn't disprove the theory, it just means it didn't have enough money. Right? If a person learns chassidus, it didn't change him, it just means he didn't learn enough. That's all, he has to learn more. Right? That doesn't disprove the theory, it just means he has to learn more. Learn the proper way, of course. Okay. So that's one idea. However, even more importantly, perhaps, is the following. That they used to say, and it's more of a, like an Elul verse, but I'll bring it in so it helps us understand this. They used to say that when a person makes a cheshbon nefesh, when a person reflects at the end of the year, for example, right? Or it doesn't have to be only in Elul, it can be before a Shchodesh, or every night, for the day, whatever the case is. When a person takes stock and really thinks about, you know, where they are in life and where they should be, there's supposed to be three parts, right? Three parts. So I hope you don't mind. Today, just more introductory, because I think it's important to set the concept here. So there's three parts. What are the three parts? First of all, this person has to be very honest of where they are. Where am I holding? So in my thought, in my speech, in my action, in a brutally honest way to know where am I. Second thing is, where should I be? And the third thing is, where can I be? Right? Now, why is that split into two? Because a person makes a cheshbon of where am I. So, yeah, I am where I am. Every person knows where they are. Their strengths and their weaknesses. They know that we're very far from where we should be. We're not always learning Torah. We're not always doing the right thing. We sometimes talk Lashon Hara. We sometimes do this. Okay, so we know where we are. Make a cheshbon in mitzvahs between man and man, mitzvahs between man and Hashem, in avodas Hashem in general. We make a cheshbon exactly where we are. Then we start thinking, where should I be? Well, where should I be? This is the book we're going to learn. So really, we should be a Beinoni, right? With all the details that the Alter Rebbe will explain in the name. And then there's, where can I be? I'm not going to be a Beinoni today or tomorrow. So what's realistic? We know, when we take on a new resolution for the new year, we have to be realistic, right? Okay. So the question the Hasidim used to ask, if it's important to know where I am, I get that. If it's important to know where can I be tomorrow or today, I get that. But then what's the point of knowing where I should be? I'm not going to get there anyway. Let me just think about where I can be rather than think about also where I should be, right? And the simple answer they gave is the following. That when you really understand properly and you keep on revisiting where I should be, it makes a different mindset, a different attitude, and it inspires that the where can I be becomes different. In other words, if I think where can I be without thinking where should I be, the where can I be is where I think I can be. When I think about where can I be in the context of where I should be, that where I should be, that goal, that almost unattainable goal, creates an attitude in my mind, it creates a mindset in my mind, it creates a way of thinking, a way of life that dents my thinking and dents my behavior so that it shifts the where can I be a little bit more. Does that make sense? Right? And that's such an important thing. So why am I saying that? Because we need to do two things when we learn chassidus. I'm talking about two things in terms of applying it, right? We need to know, first of all, and the previous Rebbe were very, very open about this. There's lots of letters to the previous Rebbe about this as well. There's a letter that the previous Rebbe once wrote to a mashpia, wrote to a head of a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Because the previous Rebbe got a letter from one of the in Torah's emes, there was a, you get a letter from some Bachrim, very serious Bachrim, that they learned in Hasidus about a certain level you can attain in davening. They want to know why they can't attain that. Like they're davening, but they're not attaining that level. And the previous Rebbe wrote such a sharp letter to the head of the yeshiva. How are you educating your things? What, you, do they really think that they that that's their level? They can attain that? I mean, what are they thinking? Like, where's the honesty? Where's the right? There wasn't. They weren't meant to be able to attain that level, right? So that's a very important thing we learn, not to distort the meaning of what we learn, to leave it where it belongs, and to understand this is what it's talking about, right? And then at the same time to think, well then what's it relevant to me? It's relevant to me because it changes my thinking and it makes a dent in what I could do, in my way of life. Right? Is that? I'll give you one quick example, just so it's clear. There's a story, and the Rebbe took this even to a new level. The Rebbe used to say that even when we learn things, even at some very high levels, we need to know that it's not relevant to us, but it is relevant to us. It's not relevant to us in terms of the level, but it's, the Rebbe used to use the expression, Efes mineu v'shemetz, Efes katseyu v'shemetz mineu, which means, Epes, something I can take away from it. So give you an example. The Rebbe once said it by Fabrenga. So there was a story with the Alter Rebbe himself. That the Alter Rebbe, famous story that there was a very, very big tzaddik, I think Shlomo Kalina, was coming to visit the Alter Rebbe. In the Alter Rebbe's house, right? The Alter Rebbe's house, his daughter used to do most of the cooking. That's where it was. Daughter would like to cook, I guess, and she would do most of the cooking. Anyway, getting a very, very special visitor. So the Rebbetzin said, the Alter Rebbe's wife said that she needs to cook that meal. Oh, daughter says, that's not fair. I always do the cooking here. So I want to have the schus of baking the meal for Shlomo Kalina. No, it's that a bit of a thing. So they decided they're going to go to the Alter Rebbe. He should judge. He should say. So they went to the Alter Rebbe, mother and daughter. Who should cook the meal for Shlomo Kalina? So the Alter Rebbe said that the daughter should cook. The mother should cook the meal, and then, but not put salt. And then the daughter will come and add the salt. I think that's the way around it was. And that when you add the salt, you can't even add salt. So when you add the salt, that's like you cook the meal. So it'll be like you both cook the meal and you both have the schus. Okay. What happened? The mother cooked the meal and she forgot she put salt. She forgot not to put salt. The daughter, knowing that her job was to put salt, she came and she put salt. Okay. Alter Rebbe and Shlomo Kalina sit down, they serve the meal, they start to eat. Alter Rebbe is eating and Shlomo Kalina takes one taste and he can't eat it. So I think the story goes that Alter Rebbe thought maybe that no one put in salt, so he added more salt, something like that. Anyways, bottom line, it was not edible. And Alter Rebbe is eating, he looks at, he says, what? Something wrong? She says, I'm really sorry, it's just over-salted. Can't. And then in great amazement, he looks at the Alter Rebbe and said, I don't understand how you eating this. It's not shy to put in your mouth. The Alter Rebbe said that ever since he came back from the Mizritcha Magid and he reached a level, he doesn't actually taste the food that he's eating. He just eats completely Shem Shemaim. He just eats only for the sake of serving Hashem. He actually has no idea what he's no taste. Now, that's not a story that's shaykh to me, shaykh to you, it's not right. And yet, the Rebbe said that we heard the story, so why do we hear it? It's got to be something, right? So what does it mean? It means that, obviously, first of all, we have to know that it's talking nothing to do with us. Like, if anyone thinks that they have any shaykhs, any connection to this level, they're just deluding themselves. On the other hand, we think about a story, we learn another story like that, maybe somehow we have a mindset that eating is not that important, so it might make a dent. On some level, or some time at least, that there can be some times that on a special day, that we elevate everything, that we're not so worried, we're not so picky about what the food, maybe, something, right? It'll make a dent in who we are, but it's not that, we're not reaching that madrega, but it's influencing us, right? And that's the general concept of how we have to learn Hasidus in general, particularly when it comes to the Beinoni that the Alter Rebbe talked about, the same idea. The Alter Rebbe says we should each strive to be a Beinoni, and we should. And we'll see what the Beinoni means, and we should try and inculcate that mindset of a Beinoni into our life without talking ourselves into it, that we become a Beinoni, if you know what I mean. Okay. So let's see how the Alter Rebbe introduces the prayer. We'll learn it a little bit in the beginning, and we'll keep going. Okay. So you have a look at the Tanya. This is the first page, right? Prayer page. Tanya, we learned in a Braise. So the Alter Rebbe quotes a Gemara, B'Soper Gimel de Nida. Mashbim Oysoi. Normally in the Gemara, when the Gemara introduces not a Mishnah, but what we call a Braisa, which is a Tanaic teaching which is not included in the Mishnah, normally the Gemara introduces it by saying the word Tanya, we have learned. Normally in the Gemara, when you see the word Tanya, you know the next thing is that there's a Braisa. It's going to be some teaching from the Tanoim, from the Tanaic period. It happens to be that in our version of the Gemara, this doesn't appear this way, the way the Alter Rebbe quotes it. Right? And in fact, it's difficult, the commentaries point out that actually we don't know yet where the Alter Rebbe actually got this version from. Obviously from somewhere, but in the more mainstream version of the Gemara, it's not introduced this way. It's actually introduced a different way. It's introduced Dorash Rabbi Simloi. Rabbi Simloi taught. And then it goes on to say the next part. Why did the Alter Rebbe choose this version? Because the Alter Rebbe wanted to start the book with the word Tanya. Right? We all call it the book of Tanya, but it's important to know what the word Tanya means. Tanya means we've learned. We've learned the Braisa, right? The reason is because the word Tanya is an important word, many, many reasons. Tanya comes from the same word as Eson, if you rearrange the letters, which means strong. And Eson is a reference to the strength of the depth of the neshama. Like the essence of the neshama is called Eson. And because the book of Tanya was really to reveal the neshama, and that's what teachings of Chassidus does in general, so that's why he wanted to start the book of Tanya. So that's why he used this version, as opposed to the mainstream version that we have in the Gemara. Okay. So we learned this in the third chapter of Nida. Mashbim oisai, that before a neshama comes down, they make him swear. They make the neshama swear, to hit tzaddik, you shall be a tzaddik, if alti rasha, and you shall not be a rasha. But even if the whole world says you're a tzaddik, you should be in your own eyes, you should consider yourself karasha, like a rasha, like a wicked person. Okay. So just before we go on, just a little bit, just a concept there. What does it mean to make the person swear? Which part of the person has to swear? Has to take this oath? Because we know we're a neshama and a body, right? Or as later we'll learn, we're a nefesh, an animal soul and a godly soul. The godly soul doesn't need to swear. The godly soul is prepared to be a tzaddik anyway, right? The animal soul, or the body, the physical, the material part of us is going to resist anyway. So what's it going to help take an oath? That's by definition, that's what the animal soul is. So who's swearing and why they're swearing? You follow what I'm saying? Yeah. So the pshat is like this, that there's a concept sometimes the Gemara mentions, mashbim ala mitzvah, that a person can take an oath that they're going to do a mitzvah. So the question is the same question. Why would you take an oath that you're going to do a mitzvah? You have to do the mitzvah anyway. So, yeah. Pshat's like this. The word shvua, which means an oath, also comes from the word saveya, to be satisfied, to be saturated. Like when you eat a lot, it's called saveya, right? That's why sometimes we refer to the month of Tishrei as Chodesh HaShvi'i. The seventh month, it is the seventh month from Nisan, but it's explained the reason that the seventh is called it because it's a month that is saveya, it is saturated with kedusha. It's Rosh Hashanah, Kippur, Sukkot, the story, right? It's saveya. So the pshat is when a person takes a shvu, when a person takes an oath, they're arming themselves, they're energizing themselves, they're infusing with themselves with another deeper energy of a power that now you have to do it, right? So what it means is that when Hashem sends an neshama down to this world, and an neshama is coming from a very high place to a very low place, and he's going to encounter a world with challenges and resistance, spiritual resistance I'm talking about, right? And it's going to be difficult, so that Hashem makes the neshama take an oath, which means Hashem saturates the neshama with extra koyach in order to withstand and to overcome the challenges that are going to be in this world. That's what it means. Okay. But what's the oath for? What's the saturation for? What's it aimed at? You should be a tzaddik and you shouldn't be a rasha. But even if the whole world tells you you're a tzaddik, you should consider yourself a rasha. Okay. That's the end of the braisa. Says the Alter Rebbe very famously, "V'tzarech lohavim," we have to understand the hotdan we have learned in Ovos Perek Beis. First of all, it's a contradiction. We learned in Pirko Ovos, the second chapter, "V'al tihi rasha b'fnei atzmocha." Never consider yourselves a rasha. It's not a good thing to do, to walk around thinking I'm a rasha. Right? So it's a contradiction between the teaching in Masechta Nida and the teaching in Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos says you should always consider yourself a Rasha. Pirkei Avos says you should never do that. So it's a contradiction. Second of all, that's a contradiction of texts. But also logically, it doesn't seem to make any sense. Why? The gamim yiyeh be'enov k'rasha, if you will consider yourself like a Rasha. So if the Torah says consider yourself a Rasha, it means honestly do that, right? We should honestly, not just say I'm a Rasha, it means we should honestly consider ourselves a Rasha. Now, what's that going to do? What's the outcome going to be? Yeira levavoy, your heart will become very sad, if you're an honest person. Via otsev, you'll feel bad and you'll be sad. You won't be able to serve Hashem with simcha. Which we know that simcha is a foundation in serving Hashem. Right? Now, what happens if a person truly considers himself like a Rasha and he's still besimcha? He's still very happy. Says the Alter Rebbe, if you don't feel bad by the fact that you are considering yourself a Rasha, then you're just going to come to frivolity. If a person walks around all life knowing and defining himself as a Rasha, but doesn't care, then that's what he's going to become. he's going to really be a Rasha, because he doesn't care to be a Rasha. Yeah? So somehow, this instruction that the Gemara says over there, that before you come down, you take a shvur to be a tzaddik and not to be a Rasha, but even if the whole world tells you you're a tzaddik, consider yourself like a Rasha, that doesn't logically play out. It's not going to be effective. Right? But if anyone wants to ask questions, don't feel free. So, what does it mean? Now, the answer to this question is in 13 chapters' time. So, stay tuned. Okay? All right. Now, so what the Alter Rebbe wants to do now is like this. He wants to go through a series of proofs about the definition. In order to understand this, we have to really understand the terms, tzaddik and rasha, right? So before we do that, we won't do everything inside in this part. I just want to lay the foundation. But so when we say, we all know that the word tzaddik and rasha, so make as if, even those who've learned Tanya, make as if you haven't learned Tanya, right? What's a tzaddik, what's a rasha? What do we mean by tzaddik and rasha? Normally?
Tzaddik is pure, absolutely. It doesn't ever happen.
That's because you learned too much Tanya. But sorry?
Connected to Hashem and distant from.
Okay, so that's a philosophical term. But truth is, it's actually a halachic term, tzaddik and rasha. Where we find the term tzaddik and rasha normally is in the laws of tshuva. The Rambam brings it and the Gemara brings it, but it's normally in terms of the way Hashem judges us. Okay? Now, we have this concept many times in Torah that we always have to, when you talk about a term, you have to understand the context, right? What the Alter Rebbe will say later is that the terms that we know tzaddik and rasha is what he calls a shem hamushal, it's a borrowed term. Meaning like this. So the legal term of tzaddik and rasha and beinoni, which the Rambam describes in the laws of tshuva and how Hashem judges us as Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur and so on, right, is that a person has mitzvahs and a person has averus. That's how it works, right? Good things and bad things. If a person has mostly mitzvahs, majority of mitzvahs is a tzaddik. Person has mostly averus is a rasha. Okay, then the Rambam says there's a whole technical way how it's worked out. Sometimes if a person has multiple things, it's counted differently. But that's not the point now. The point is that's sort of, a beinoni is like some in the middle, average guy, has got some mitzvahs, some averus, right? Which is what the Rambam says, that when a person comes to Rosh Hashanah, if they're a tzaddik, they right away judge favorably. If they're a rasha, right away not so favorably. If it's a beinoni, Hashem gives the seris mei tshuva to try and work it out. That's your chance, you know, sway it, or do tshuva so that you can, okay. Okay, obviously, if a person's even a rasha, they can do tshuva, we know that. But that's what the Rambam describes over there, without going into all the intricacies of Hilchos tshuva, right? But it's obviously a lot deeper than that. Okay? Now, it's important as we go through this to understand, because what you're going to understand in this chapter is that we're all at the level of a Rasha, which sounds very depressing. Right? Meaning, not level Rasha in the legal term, I hope, but in the Tanya term, in the true meaning of Rasha, right? So, I want you just to know, that goes to what I was saying in the beginning about being honest with ourselves but not being put off by it, right? There was a chassid of the Alter Rebbe, there's two stories. There's a chassid of the Alter Rebbe that Ril Parcha, I think, said that Ril Parcha he became a chassid of the Alter Rebbe, but before that he was an opponent of the Alter Rebbe. But he was a very big person. He was a big Talmud Chacham and a big Tzaddik and he knew Kabbalah. He knew unbelievable thing, right? And then he came close to the Alter Rebbe, this whole story, and then he started to learn Tanya. He always used to say that before I came to Alter Rebbe, I thought I was a tzaddik. And now, halavai beinoni. That's what he said. I wish I would be a beinoni. Helps a man, exactly. There was another chassid who said that he's not just a regular Rasha. He says he's not even a Rasha. And Alter Rebbe is going to explain later that there's two levels of a Rasha. He's not even a lower level of a Rasha. Why? Because he said, if something is mentioned in Tanya, it must be a little bit of a level already. And so he's not even a Rosh of a Rala. He's not even a real Rosh. And by the way, the Chassidim were the happiest people because, you know, they were honest about themselves, but they knew Hashem, they just need to work and they need to strive and they need to keep working on themselves, and that's what you need to do, right? Because
a good person and a bad person.
Yes, that's the normal way of understanding it. So, but I wanted to say that when we learn now and we come to the conclusion, which we should and will, if we're honest, that basically we all fit into the category, hopefully, of a Rasha, it doesn't mean a bad person. That's what I'm saying. We're not bad people. But we're deficient people. And that's okay. It's okay to be deficient. That's right. We're very deficient people. And that's fine. You know what's fine also? I think there's another foundation of Chassidus, which is very, very important. Because at the end of the day, it's actually not even about us. Right? One of the themes we're going to learn, you know what they used to say also this used to be talked about a lot about during Elul time. Let's say a person did something really bad, taka bad. Let's say a person fell in and he fell into a very big avera, let's say, right? Okay, and then he felt really, really bad about it, right? And the next morning he comes to shul, he wants to daven, but he can't daven. He's just feeling so bad about the avera he did yesterday. He can't daven properly, right? She used to say that's a much bigger avera. The fact that you don't want to daven today because what you did yesterday was terrible. Was very deficient, it was against Hashem, it was true, you have to do tshuva for it, and there's times to do tshuva, you have to cry to Hashem to forgive you, all good, all true. But what's going to do it today? Today Hashem wants you to daven, so now you've got to put yourself into complete davening. The fact that you feel bad and can't daven is because you're so wrapped in yourself. It's got nothing to do with Hashem, it's got to do with you. In other words, if your mindset would be that it's all about me connecting to Hashem, it's not about me altogether, which is one of the foundations of Chassidus, taking away what we call the ich, right? The focus on self. Which in today's culture is a very difficult thing to do, right? If you then taka did something really bad yesterday, but today's davening, Hashem wants me to daven, so I should throw myself into it with the greatest of joy. That doesn't mean I mustn't take responsibility for yesterday. I'll set aside time, I'll think about that, I might even feel guilty, I'll do tshuva. That's true, but the fact that I'm feeling bad, therefore I can't do a mitzvah now, that's because I'm focusing on me. I feel bad, I'm guilty, so I can't do what Hashem wants me to do today. You understand what I'm saying?
But on a metaphysical level, you've put up a clipper.
You have.
So it will impact your davening.
It will impact your davening spiritually, but not because you feel guilty. Okay, so you have to break through that clip. You have to break through that barrier. That's true. And everything we do impacts the other. It does and it doesn't. In other words, if we try, it won't impact. It makes davening harder, but not. It shouldn't make it harder in terms of my attitude. Yeah, we might find that the davening is not as pure as yesterday's davening because I need to do tshuva for the bad thing I did yesterday. True. But it doesn't mean that I can't throw myself into the mitzvah with the greatest enthusiasm.
Well, maybe you have to do that, so overcome the clipper.
Correct. Maybe it's also
part. It was the beginning.
Yeah.
Stop doing that.
Exactly. You've got to throw yourself into it. Exactly. And I'm just saying that. I'm saying because we can learn about things that, as I said before, we'll learn about a Russia. If according to Al Tareb's definition, he's going about to say, so. It's hard, I mean, we're certainly not a Benyani, so it looks like we fit into the next category, which is the Russia, which is fine. I mean, it's not fine, but it's honest, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't make us the bad people, doesn't make us the people that can't serve Hashem and do mitzvahs, and doesn't make our mitzvahs any less valuable. On the contrary, the whole point of Tanya is that when you're distant and you overcome, and the more you overcome, it's actually more valuable in a way, right? As we'll talk about in greater detail. Okay, let's see. So how does he introduce it? He introduces it the following way. It says, he says, we find in the Gemara, hey chalukos. We have to start from the beginning. Where do we find the terms of tzaddik and rasha? So we find in the Gemara, first of all, five definitions. The Gemara talks about five definitions. The Gemara says, tzaddik, the simple shot is as follows. Tzaddik v'toivloi, we find a tzaddik which is going well for him, meaning a tzaddik that is prosperous and enjoys health and wealth. Tzaddik v'raloi, a tzaddik, but it's actually going bad for him. He's a tzaddik, but things aren't working out for him. Rasha v'toivloi, a wicked person and is prosperous. Rasha v'raloi, Rasha is a wicked person, mitaka going bad. Ubeinani, right? What's a simple pshat? Upirusha b'gemara. Tzaddik v'toivloi, a good tzaddik gomor, means a perfect tzaddik. The simple pshat in this gemara is that he's perfect tzaddik, therefore Hashem rewards him fully. He doesn't have to suffer for anything because he's a perfect tzaddik. Tzaddik v'raloi, imperfect tzaddik, tzaddik she'en gomer. Is it imperfect tzaddik, so Hashem is doing him a favor. In other words, he's a tzaddik. He's not a perfect tzaddik. So Hashem gives him suffering in this world. So then when he comes to the next world, I mean, this is a simple pshat, right? When he comes to the next world, he's pure. Okay, the problem with that is then, what is a bainli? Why don't we have a two? Is a bainli going well? Not going well. So, b'raya mehemne parshas mishpatim. So in Raya Mehemna, which is the Zohar, in Parashat Mishpatim, Pirush, he says, no, it means like this. We're not talking about a tzaddik that is going well for him, we're talking about a certain type of tzaddik. Tzaddik v'raloi means a tzaddik that is bad for him, meaning means like this. Sharashaboy kofuf letoiv. It means he's a tzaddik, he's got a trace of bad in him, but that trace of bad is completely controlled by the good. So a tzaddik gomer means he has no bad in him. Tzaddik she'enu gomer means, tzaddik v'ralo means he's got a little bit of deficiency, but it's not relevant because it's completely controlled by the good. We don't have to go into this now because later on the Alter Rebbe goes really deep into it, right? Okay, what does it mean? And same thing with, as we'll see later, with the Rasha. You have a Rasha that's just a complete Rasha. You have a Rasha with a little bit of good, but the good is not helping him because the good is like swallowed up in the bad kind of thing. Okay. Now, we need to understand what all this means. Later on, it says, "Gemara sof perik testa brachas." The Gemara at the end of the ninth perik of brachas says, "Tzadikim yetzer toiv shoiftan." Tzadikim are ruled by the yetzer toiv. Rishoyim yetzer hara shoiftan. Rishoyim are ruled by the yetzer hara, by the evil inclination. Beinim zev zeh shoiftan. A beinim is the word ruled here is inaccurate. Really, it's judged. He's ruled and judged by both of them. A tzadik. Then the Gemara says over there, interesting thing. Omar Rabbe says, Kagona no Beini. If you want to know an example of a Beini, that's me. Now, Rabbe was an amazing, amazing tzaddik, right? Omar Le Abaye, so Rabbe's the student. Abaye said to him, Rebbe, Le Shovik Mar Chaylo Chol Beria. If you are making yourself a Beini, you're not leaving much life for anyone else. Why? Because we know that we say tzaddikim are called alive even after they pass away. Rishoyim, really wicked people, are called dead even in this world. So if you're a Beinoni, that makes us all real wicked people. In which case, we're a problem, right? Okay. Ulavin calls their Bayer Heitiv, says the Alter Rebbe, to understand all this really well, because we need to understand also what was Rabbi saying, right? How could Rabbi misdiagnose himself like that way spiritually, right? Now, you could say he was being humble. But we know a rule. Humility has to make sense. False humility is not a good thing, right? Like a person can't be a genius and know the whole shas of per heart and say, I'm an ignoramus. I mean, that's being stupid, right? You can say, my learning is nothing special. You can say, if a person knows the whole of shas, knows all the shas. I mean, Rabbi knew who he was, right? Rabbi was a person that, as he says later in the perek, that when he learned Torah so constantly that even when it came to die, similar to David HaMelech, the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, couldn't get him because he had to do a whole trick because he was just learning the whole time. His whole life he just learned. That's all he did, right? So there's no question that Rabbi was a tzaddik, right? So if a tzaddik means mostly a mitzvahs, and a beinoni means half mitzvahs and half averis, that's not even Rabbi's world. I mean, that's ridiculous humility. That wouldn't be true, right? So that's already a proof that we're misunderstanding in the truth of the words, misunderstanding what the word tzaddik and beinoni is. So in other words, this question will become answered much later, but in essence, what comes out, the Alter Rebbe says many chapters later, I think in chapter 14, 15, right, explains that because we'll understand what a tzaddik is, because we'll understand what a beinoni is, we'll understand that beinoni is also a very high madrega, even though more attainable to the common person than a tzaddik is. We can understand, we'll learn how Rabbi could make that mistake. It was a mistake. Rabbi was a tzaddik, a real tzaddik. But we'll understand why he perceived himself out of humility as a beinoni. Right? Okay. Then he says, v'gam lahovin, also we have to understand, Masha Omar Iyov, what Iyov said, according to the Gemara, Iyov said, Rabbeinu Shalom, the master of the universe, barasa tzaddikim, barasa roshoy. You created tzaddikim, you created roshoy. Which is in itself a problematic statement. Because the Gemara says that Hashem creates everything, He doesn't create tzaddikim and rishoyim, He creates free choice. Right? There's a malach that comes to Hashem before a person is born and says, shall I make this person dumb or smart, rich or poor, healthy or strong or weak? Right? These things are part of the genes, the genealogy of a person. Okay, you can change that through tefillah, but that is, there's dispositions when a person is born, right? But it doesn't say tzaddik and rasha, because that's up to the person. Bechira, right? So how could Eof say you created tzaddik and rasha? So the thesis, which we're not going to do in Israel, I'll just end off, because I want to next week start from the end of chapter 1, where he introduces the two souls. So the Alter Rebbe ends off with the following. He brings proofs that we need to understand that this tzaddik and, that this whole tzaddik and benyani and rasha thing that we understand is a borrowed legal term, which is used in a legal context. And that's why Hashem views a person in terms of how you want to be judged. You want to be in trouble, not in trouble. At tzaddik and rasha and benyani is the way we always understand it, right? However, in terms of the true definition, the Alter Rebbe brings proofs, many proofs, that when a person does an avera, at that point, at that time, especially when he's doing the avera, he's a rasha. Even a rabbinic avera, even a avera not learning enough Torah, anything. Even if he could stop someone else doing an avera, the Gemara says he doesn't stop him, he's called a rasha, right? If he does proper tshuva afterwards, he's a tzaddik. So, and there's proofs from Allah. So where does a bayani come into this, right? Meaning tzaddik in the legal sense. We know this from the Gemara. The Gemara says if someone says to a woman, a man says to a woman, I'm giving you a ring for kiddushin, and he makes a condition, right? And he says, I'm this marriage should only take effect on condition that I'm a tzaddik. So we say that even if he's a rasha, even if he's a well-known rasha, she needs a get to remarry someone else because she could be married. It's possible. Why is it possible? Maybe he had a thought of tshuva. Maybe the tshuva in his mind that would transform him from a tzaddik, from a rasha into a tzaddik in a legal sense, right? So then she would need a get, right? So that's so where's the benyani then? So he says that tzaddik, rasha, and benyani, the way we've always understood it, is the borrowed term. But we have to understand that it's a benyani is someone, and this he introduces it here, but he comes back to it later. A benyani is someone that actually doesn't do any sins. But, as we'll learn later in Tanya, he's not a tzaddik because he still is tempted to sin. He still struggles. That's a benyani. And that's why the book of Tanya becomes the model for the average person. With the point of the Alter Rebbe is going to explain at length how we try and get there, and how we develop the mindset to go on that journey, Bichlal, because he's going to explain that the average person has control. We have bechira, we have the capacity that our mind should rule our hearts, and we should actually choose the right way. But it's a very long and involved path of developing a sense of avas Hashem and love of Hashem, and so on and so on and so forth. But we don't have the power within us to eradicate the temptation altogether. That's reserved for a very, very few select people. That's a tzaddik, right? But a person who does a virus is still, in the true sense of the world, hasn't come close to a tzaddik, he's not even a bayani. Whereas a bayani is someone who actually does not do any virus, but still has that challenge to do an virus on some level at least, right? Which needs to be broken down and understood properly, but that's the essence. In order to understand all of that, this is all introduction. We'll start next week. We'll start the end part of Perek Aleph and go on a long journey to understand how we work, the makeup of the human being, and the makeup of a yid in particular, of the two souls, the animal soul and the godly soul. Okay.